This talk was recorded by Insight Meditation South Bay. For more talks and information, visit www.imsb.org.
So this is the first in the series of strengthening mindfulness. And I think that this talk tonight works well into the first talk because it's really going to be about looking at, you know, what is mindfulness and how do we understand applying mindfulness to our lives. So the title of the talk is actually The Presence of Mindfulness. And I thought I would have kind of another element to this talk, which was a kind of a visual demonstration. So I have here in this gift box the different presents. This is the big present itself, the different presents that mindfulness brings. And so whenever I talk about one of the presents, which is really kind of a teaching that we can bring into our life, you'll see a little object that represents it. There's a lot of presence in there. So I was looking up definitions of mindfulness. There's many, and it really, it's not that they're all totally different, but there's two that I chose that I think are describe mindfulness really well. And I wanted to just start with a definition by James Barres. Mindfulness is simply being aware of what is happening right now without wishing it were different, enjoying the pleasant without holding on when it changes, which it will, being with the unpleasant without fearing it will always be this way, which it won't. And then there's one by Sylvia Wirstein, which is very similar. How she says it is, mindfulness is the aware, balanced acceptance of the present experience. It isn't more complicated than that. It's opening to or receiving the present moment, pleasant or unpleasant, just as it is, without either clinging to it or rejecting it. So mindfulness is, it's a way of getting out of this categorization that we do so commonly through our everyday life. It's so incessant we don't even know half the times that we're doing it. So it's, it's what both Sylvia and James are saying is that we have this tendency to cling to what we want or be averse to what we don't want. And so it's, I like this, I don't like this, I want, I don't want. I'm good, I'm bad. And, it's one of the things that I was saying in the meditation is this alert, relaxed posture. It's that balance point where you're not feeling like you're tipped 10 degrees to the left, so that if only you had a little bit more money or, were a little bit better looking or had a different profession or whatever it was, that then everything would be okay. And so we have this kind of habit of putting on this filter between ourselves and our experience of evaluating and, assessing whether we like this or we don't like it. And it really gets in the way of just being able to fully experience life and fully being who we are. Because we tend to not only be extremely critical in life, but we tend to be even more so critical about ourselves. I've heard this time period being explained as an epidemic of stress, and that we've never been more judgmental than around now. And more than anything, our judgment is towards ourselves. something that John Lennon said is, life is what's happening when we're busy making other plans. So that's what we would refer to as mindlessness, not being where we actually are at, but being somewhere lost in our head. You know, oftentimes driving down the freeway, passing the exit, and not realizing that there it is. So mindfulness is it's considered the heart of Buddhist psychology. Or, like, I was looking at the flyer for this talk, and mindfulness is described as the heart of Buddhist meditation, and it's one of the factors on the Eightfold Path. So there's right effort, right concentration, right mindfulness. Right really refers more to wise. So what is wise mindfulness? It's the attentional process that, when we were talking about attention and intention, it's how to place your attention and how to keep your intention on where you want it to be. Intention is a big deal in Buddhist psychology. It's and I'm going to talk about that as much more so as one of the gifts. But in every mind moment, we have an intention that determines our future well-being. So the attentional process is both attention and intention. Mindfulness is also about investigation, and it allows us to see deeply and clearly. I was talking about this kind of lens of categorization, liking and not liking, and clinging, aversion. And that's like a lens that's between us and our experience. And so when we can investigate through mindfulness, which is a lens of neutrality, then we can see that, oh, I'm not my thought. You know, if I say, oh, I'm an idiot, then we can see, because if we have a neutral lens, saying I am an idiot is judgmental. And it's a total assumption that may not be true. In fact, it isn't true, because really down deep, we're very good. There's this original goodness in all of us, in our core. And so mindfulness gives us the ability to investigate what's really true, because we can see out of a neutral, non-judgmental lens. And then true mindfulness, or wise mindfulness, is also bringing attitudes of, like, compassion, so that whatever it is that we're feeling, we can hold it in the arms of compassion. Because it can be really difficult to feel, panicky or very angry or hopeless. But if we hold ourselves in compassion, it can make that be okay. So through this attentional process, investigation, and qualities that are cultivated, compassion and other ones, that mindfulness allows us to develop insight. And there's three characteristics of reality that trip us up, because we resist what's actually common to what's true to being on Earth. So the first one is called dukkha. That means suffering or dissatisfaction. And just being alive means that there is inherent suffering. Sometimes dukkha is called dissatisfaction. Well, you know, we get old, we get sick, we lose jobs, we lose relationships. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff. And it gets down to, oh, we didn't make the green light. You know, we were a little bit late here. There's also, you know, my back hurts. So suffering is inherent, and when we resist this basic nature of reality, that suffering or dissatisfaction is a fact, that it causes us to, it gets in our way. You know, rather than being able to deal with what's at hand, we're dealing more with, like, the frustration, the exasperation, the anger, the depression. And that makes it so much more difficult to deal with what it is that we have to deal with. So the second truth of reality is what's called anicca, which is that everything changes. You know, life is impermanent. Everything comes and goes, and yet we have this need to kind of hold on to this state of stability. It's, you know, there's a feeling that, like, if things kind of are constant, that we're going to feel more secure or more sane or something. And but it really just increases our insecurity, because we're constantly changing all the time. Life is changing all the time. And so when we're clinging on to this sense of constancy, that causes a lot of despair or discontent. And then the third truth of reality is what's called anicca, or no self. And I'm going to be talking a lot more about these later in the talk. But it's this concept of, we have this fixed sense of self that's also solid and stable, and we think of ourself in a certain way. It's really like our assumptions of who we think we are. It's another way of calling this is our ego. But and so we end up getting insulted, you know, or taking things personally. Things happen, and then we personalize it as though it's a reflection on ourself. And this is it's called also the delusion of the separate self. There's me, my I, here, and there's everything else out there. And so it's this kind of way of having to protect ourselves from the other, what's there. So, like, one of the things that I am using mindfulness for right now is to know that, like, even though I know just a few of you in here, but really we're all in this together. You know, really, really, you're all sort of, we're all friends here. We all are part of this human existence. And so it's not so much me up here giving this talk and you out there and how you're perceiving me, but really we're sharing in this experience together, and we're all learning here. So, you know, in many ways, mindfulness is—it's more than about attention. It's more than a stress reduction technique. It's more than knowing how to be calm and relaxed. It's considered a way of being. And so, this there's a expression by Eleanor Roosevelt, and it goes, "Yesterday is history. Tomorrow is mystery. Today is a gift. That's why they call it the present." And so here we are with the first gift. So how do we enter into the present moment? I know that the first series here was on mindfulness meditation. And I don't know if anyone here came to that series, but when you learn how to meditate with mindfulness, which, by the way, is part of so there's two kind of classifications of meditation. There's the concentration meditation with the mantra, and then there's the awareness or insight practices. And mindfulness comes under insight meditation, which is also Vipassana. And So when you learn how to do mindfulness meditation, which is an awareness practice, it's just being aware of all of the senses and using different objects to anchor our attention. So that first class is using the breath as the object of attention. The second is using the body. The third is using emotions as the object of attention in the meditation. The fourth is thoughts. And then the fifth is what kind of quality of attention are you bringing in? So this all helps to anchor us to the present moment. So the breath is central in not only in mindfulness, but in all meditation practices and throughout history, the history basically of the world. I mean, it's found in all religions in terms of like rosary beads and mala beads, anchoring attention. And just a little bit of background about the breath. So, you know, we have the stress response, which is also called the fight and flight response. And it's actually activated by the breath. And so when you get really scared, like, I don't know, like when you heard about 9/11, when that happened, actually the first thing that happens is the breath. And it's that gasp. So we have this shortened breath. It's called conditioned breathing because we lose our natural way of breathing and just go as far as down as the chest. Well, that keeps the stress response on. And sometimes we need that because we have an emergency situation. So this evolves basically because, you know, when we had the saber-toothed tigers around, we needed to instantly activate the stress response and turn on this alarm system in the body so that we could run really, really quickly and get ourselves out of danger. So we had to know how to just react without thinking to all the dangers. But the problem is that the body can't distinguish between physiological danger and psychological danger. And there's so many psychological dangers that we have in our day. The first one would be, can anyone guess? Like the sound of the alarm clock. I mean, when it goes off. I mean, and so we're constantly bombarded by what I call like the demon tigers. So it's these, you know, these mythological sort of like creatures in our head that's telling us, oh, we have to like watch out. And because we take things so personally, these demon tigers that I'm going to kind of change because I couldn't find a tiger, but I did find a dragon, they're just everywhere. But fortunately, we have the relaxation response, which is also activated by the breath. And that's when we get into the belly breathing. And so one of the things that you might have noticed when we did our meditation was follow the breath sensations in the body. And if you could notice the belly moving out on the inhalation and in on the exhalation, then what you know is that the body, the breath is going down deeply where it naturally is meant to be. So that, you know, when you see a little baby in the crib lying down on his or her back, that belly is just, it's just like this balloon, like just lifting and falling. And we've really kind of lost that ability to just do that. I mean, part of it is that we're supposed to be bringing our, you know, holding our belly in because we want to kind of have flat bellies, but also because we're kind of stressed out most of the time. Well, one of the things about the breath as a object of attention is that even though relaxation is not the it's not the goal of mindfulness, it turns out to be a natural outcome. Because once you start really kind of letting go and bringing on this neutral attention, the breath will just lower and deepen and slow on its own. So I don't know if anyone, if you find that when you're meditating. Sometimes, you know, what I was saying is that once you, sometimes when you start paying attention to the breath, you translate it that as like, ooh, control. You know, I've got to like control the breath. So, but if you just allow yourself to follow the breath, you will get into this kind of natural rhythmic flow. So this first little present of mindfulness is, so this is what I was talking about with the demon dragon. So it's just noticing when you have these demon dragons appearing. And if that's the case, you're probably involved in this chest breathing. And so mindfulness is just, it's so much about just being aware of what's happening. And so noticing, you know, demon dragon, and then going into that antidote, which is the relaxation response, bringing the breath down to the belly. And I have, this is like a teddy bear. Sort of, you know, this little kind of place where we can feel nurtured and taken care of and soothed and calmed. So the breath also is a way of, you know, cultivating non-judgment, because it teaches us to just, you know, we have our attention on the breath, we have our intention to stay with the breath, but if the mind wanders, and I am sure that you all found the mind naturally wanders because that's what the mind does, so you just, you know, make a mental note. It's helpful to make the mental note because it's just this labeling, and you can kind of let go more when you label. You can say thinking or wandering, but oftentimes thinking kind of helps, and you just bring it back. And so teaches us that there's, you know, to anchor our attention. It cultivates non-judgment. And I heard the analogy of when you're walking around with judgment, it's sort of like when you're driving a car and the windshield has a film on it. And so, you know, you could be driving for miles or days, even weeks, without noticing that the windshield is dirty. And then for some reason you turn on the windshield wipers, you know, you either notice it or the windshield is like so dirty or whatever. And it's so clear, and it's like you could see everything with so much more, you know, color and vividness. And that's like what happens when you take out the lens of judgment, and when you can see clearly in this more neutral way without this overlay. So the gift here is the lens of judgment. And I don't know if you can notice, but these are really dirty, and so everyone is looking really kind of a little murky to me right now. And here is looking from the lens of mindfulness. And the reason why the problem is it's sunglasses, so it'd be better if they were clear lenses. But I chose the heart because what happens is that if you're looking through the lens of judgment, that if you're like driving a car and you're in a situation where, you know, are you going to let this person come in front of you? Well, if you're in this judgmental place, you're usually kind of stressed out, or you're not really, you're more of this me versus them kind of place. But if you're letting go of the judgment and being in a more mindful state, you enter into this zone called kind of we zone. You know, and it's sort of what I was talking about. It's, there's not this separation between me and everyone, you out there. And so you're actually much more likely to let that person in. So this lens with the heart is, you know, we end up coming from a, you know, when we don't have judgment, we these other qualities get cultivated, like compassion and kindness and generosity and non-striving, and so our world can and our world experience can feel very different. Okay, so a little bit more about intention. So I talked about intention in the meditation, and by the way, so the meditations are like these. It's like the vehicles. In a very short amount of time, you learn about mindfulness. But in mindfulness has what's called the formal practices and the informal. So the formal is like the meditations or yoga, and the informal is like how to bring mindfulness with you through the day. And so, intentions are often talked in Buddhism as seeds. So it's planting the seeds of intention. So, the gardener will choose the seeds based on what plants he or she wants to grow. So, you want to grow a rose, you get some rose seeds. So in similarly, what you the intentions that you nurture will be what unfolds in your life. So everything is about intentions. It's in Buddhist psychology, your future well-being is influenced by the intentions that you nurture. So if you get into this kind of mindset of anger, and you plant that seed of anger, that develops into hatred. If you conversely plant the seed of love or kindness, then what gets nurtured is compassion. So in every mind moment, you're planting seeds of intention that will determine your future well-being. So the gift here is GMO-free seeds. I give some mindfulness classes for fertility. A lot of the classes that I give, and I have this whole seed exercise, and really encourage people to plant seeds and really pay attention to nurturing them, giving them enough water, enough sunlight. And then if nothing grows, then it's practicing, mindfulness in the form of, like, no judgment, begin again. Maybe, you might want to plant the seeds in a different place or try new seeds. But there's all sorts of ways that, you can plant intentions in your life. So the second way that we can enter into the present moment is through the body. So mindfulness is called an embodied practice because what we really do is thoughts and emotions and experience are felt through the body. And so, if we say, I'm angry. Well, first of all, that's personalizing. It's not really, it's, if you look deeply into it, it's in coming from a place of mindfulness, it would be, this is anger. And so then what do? You look at, well, what does anger feel like? And so, what are the sensations of anger in the body? So it's getting to know anger or whatever it is through the body. And so mindfulness is thought as this embodied practice. That's also one of the reasons why sound can be used as an object of attention. It's opening up to all these different ways where the body interfaces with the world through sound, through taste. You can have a mindfulness object of attention of taste. So when you're sitting down and eating, it's fully experiencing the tastes and the sensation of bringing the fork to the mouth and what it feels like with food going down your throat. And you know, when you smell it, just bringing in the different aromas. And so, you know, mindfulness is being fully awake to your senses. So one of the things I really love about mindfulness is what's called the pause. And so we have, you know, these thoughts arise, these kind of knee-jerk reactions. I like this, I don't like this, I suck, I'm great, but it's all reactive for the most part. Well, mindfulness, it's like you notice something arising, because there's always these arisings and passings. So you notice the arising of a feeling or a thought, and then rather than typically being on automatic pilot, and if we're feeling angry, then, you know, swearing or whatever it is that we do, we notice it and we pause. And that gives us the chance to make a conscious choice over how we want to respond. So it takes us out of automatic reactivity mode and into conscious responding. So there's this practice that I learned in mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a program that was started over 30 years ago by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And it's called the stop practice. Mindfulness always has these kind of three parts. There's, you know, so you notice and you stop, you observe, and you observe, okay, your thought, you observe your emotion, you observe what's happening in your body, and then you return. Well, MBSR has made an acronym for it. It's called STOP. So S is, so, you know, you're sitting there and you are starting to get frustrated. And so you stop. And then T is take a breath. So this is, again, where that abdominal, that belly breath comes in. So, you know, belly breathing is our natural healing mechanism. Andrew Wild refers to belly breathing as the master key to self-healing. So we have this part of us that's always with us. And so when the T for take a breath is there, it's really taking a breath from the belly so that we can get that relaxation response turned on, which the breath turns it on in the hypothalamus, which is where the relaxation response originates. So then the O in stop is observe. Okay, so you have a thought, and you just notice the thought. You don't dissect it or anything. And then you observe the emotion. Because what happens is we usually have a thought, it triggers an emotion. Sometimes it's the opposite. But there's an emotion that's attached to the thought. Just notice whatever it is. And then how is the body holding it? So the body is, again, this is an embodied practice. And so you put your attention into the body. So, like, what does frustration feel like in the body? Well, I don't know, tight shoulders, kind of agitated, you know, sort of like a hand that's kind of moving around, and maybe kind of tightness in the chest. And so then you know, you might breathe. Imagine bringing the breath into and out from the chest, sort of like opening up here. Or something that's oftentimes recommended is actually doing a stop at a stoplight, and using a stoplight as just that natural place to practice. And so, you know, if you notice that you're tense, it's loosening the grip on the winch, on the steering wheel, it's changing your posture. So you're working with the body in that O, observing place. And then the P in stop is proceed out of that more mindful place to be. So stop, take a breath, observe, and proceed. So this is a stop sign. Okay. So just something else about the body, and that is that the body is more reliable than our thoughts, because our thoughts create stories that aren't true. And these stories gets us into a lot of trouble. I mean, it kind of takes us down this rabbit hole. And before we know it, we've created this kind of crisis. And so the body is this reliable source that speaks the truth. And so what you want to do is, use the body as that place of kind of doing the work and allow your emotions to just sort of be there, because the body is this big container and it can hold it all. So the thing about emotions is that, emotions, just like thoughts, are not seen as good or bad. They're seen as wholesome or unwholesome. And it's all about just noticing, is this a wholesome thought or is this an unwholesome thought? Because wholesome emotions will lead towards wholesome actions, and unwholesome emotions will lead towards unwholesome actions. So that an unwholesome emotion would be feeling like closed down, feeling scared. And so we might feel kind of constricted or we might tend to like stay at home and not do anything or like zone out. So if we notice this unwholesome emotion, we don't want to nurture that. This is again the whole role of intentions. And so we want to basically give room for emotions to just be in our body. And if you give room for them, they'll just sort of like run their course. So there's this analogy in Buddhism, salt in the water. So if you put a teaspoon of salt in a cup and you taste it, it's very salty. If you put it in a pot, it's still salty, but not quite so much. But if you put it in a pond and taste the pond, you don't taste any salt at all. So this is the analogy of disturbance of the mind is, if you give it kind of wide space, it disperses in a kind of a wide and open mind, just like salt in a pond disperses when you have more space for it. So the gift for this one is, since I couldn't quite pass around salt, I thought I would use food coloring. So if I put one drop of this food coloring, this is an emotion. And so in a small space, if you start constricting, I mean, you could see it's so dense that all you can see, like, basically is the emotion. You can't see past it. But if you put the same amount of emotion, food coloring in this case, in a large container, which is your body, that you can see how it just sort of actually is very beautiful how it disperses. And just kind of starts moving through you and changes shape. You start feeling what this emotion feels like. And if you let it really fully disperse, it has a very light tint to it. And, what I notice is that, like, if you can look through it and see to the other side, meaning that you could see what your options are. So just always remember to give emotions space so that they can flow and dissipate on their own. So next is thoughts. So the basic premise in Buddhist psychology is craving. And if you cling to a particular thought which is like craving, this causes a lot of suffering. And so we get attached to the thought as though like nothing else matters. It's this clinging, and thoughts are very seductive, and they're seductive because we have this emotion that's attached, and these emotions kind of confirm that this thought is true. So, mindfulness is very much about welcoming what's here and noticing your tendency to hold on too tightly, or to try to get rid of, or to deny. And so you want to notice the quality of your attention. This is something that we were doing in the meditation. Are you holding on to wanting your meditation to be different in some way? Because you don't want to lose the focus, or your back hurts or whatever it is. And so you want to look at the quality of attention. So there's a story in Buddhism in India, where the way that you catch a monkey is you get a coconut, you drill a hole in, and you put a banana. So the monkey is attracted to the banana. I guess they could smell it or something, and they put their hand in this little hole, hold on to the banana, and they won't let go. And so all the hunters have to do is go over, see the monkey, and they've caught it because the monkey won't let go of the banana. And this is what we do. We cling on to things, as though we're clinging on to dear life, and that gets us into a lot of trouble. So the gift for that is this. I couldn't find a coconut, but it's clinging to this and like not being able to actually can get my hand out because I'm just so needing to have this that I will go through the rest of the evening with my hand in a jar. Okay, and just something else about thoughts that so Buddhist psychology points to our beliefs and how tightly we hold on to them that causes our mental suffering. So it's not about getting rid of our thoughts, it's how to see thoughts skillfully. And there's a story of Buddha and the three arrows. So Buddha says to his students, how would you feel if you were hit by an arrow? And his students say, oh, terrible. What about two arrows? Oh, that much worse. Well, what about three arrows? Absolutely horrible. And so Buddha says, well, the first arrow is unavoidable suffering. The second arrow is our thoughts about, why didn't I get out of the way? Self-recrimination. The third arrow is, oh my gosh, I'll never be able to walk again. I won't be able to support my family. And so it's this, what he calls optional, or I guess I'm not sure if he called it, but anyway, what we call optional suffering. It's how we make our suffering so much worse by how our thoughts are relating to it. So thoughts are seen as mental formations. Oftentimes it's like clouds passing through the sky. Sometimes thoughts are seen as like bubbles floating to the surface. And I thought that one way of kind of being able to see thoughts so that you can, not see them as like I am. Like we tend to believe that we are our thought, but we're not. So if we can see them in this neutral way, they don't have this hold on us. So as I blow the bubble, just imagine that these are mental formations. And they just form and pop and float away. Okay.
Oh, and sometimes they, but they will eventually. They take different forms, and but that is not me. So I'm noticing I want to leave some time for a little bit of questions and answers, so I'm just going to really go through the rest of this quickly. I talked about insight arising from mindfulness. So dukkha, meaning suffering. So what happens is that we resist this basic nature of, you know, suffering existing. And there's this equation, pain times resistance equals suffering. So it's our resistance that makes so much of a difference. And what we want to do is just always notice if we're resisting. So if we're suffering, just notice we're suffering. And usually it's because we're resisting that, you know, we don't want this to be happening or we don't like it. So just notice the resistance. And it's kind of like if you're caught under a waterfall, what you don't want to do is try to swim up because it's too hard. You actually want to go in the opposite direction. And so mindfulness teaches us to not resist, to actually move towards that very thing that is actually causing suffering. And so in the waterfall example, you would actually swim down. And then when you get out of the force of the waterfall, it actually just kind of pops you up. The opposite of resistance is acceptance. And acceptance in mindfulness means just being with what is. And so that little gift is... So, you know, it's the metaphor for if you try really hard, you know, the harder you try, the more stuck you become. So if you go towards, you actually have more space and you can get out really easily. And then that second truth of reality is anicca, patience. And so the gift around that is that if we can see that everything's changing, we take on a kind of patience. And patience is actually considered a form of wisdom. So what we learn is that it's really not the outcome that matters, it's the process. So rather than being so oriented towards how things work out, it's looking at what I was talking about in meditation. Just keep coming back. So if you are falling, I use the metaphor of like a kite. So if the kite goes to the ground, it's just, you know, picking the kite up and bringing it up again. So it's not what happens that matters. It's how we deal with it. And for that, I have a paper airplane. So, like, regardless of how this flies, it's just the process of just trying. And, you know, if I had all the time in the world, I'd try again until I figured out just the perfect kind of airplane that stayed up for at least a few seconds longer. There it is. And then lastly, this notion of no self. So we hold on to this fixed sense of self as though there's this sort of overlay of us and on top of the world. But this no self is really kind of this ever-fluctuating flow of experience, rather than this kind of permanent sense of who we are and based on our assumptions of who we think we should be. And this causes a lot of suffering because we oftentimes have these expectations, and the expectations are basically the need to be perfect, and we just can't measure up. And so this concept of no self, this flow of experience, allows us to feel like we're a part of the world, we're connected, and to get in touch with our what's called our original nature, which is our Buddha nature. And inside, we're already whole and complete just as we are. with all of our imperfections and inadequacies. And so just the last kind of thing that I want to say is, when you accept these three truths of reality, you bring an end to your suffering. And so there's this phrase, when you look at zero, you see nothing, but when you look through it, you see the world. And there's one other phrase, and that's, in the very process of knowing self, you lose self and you gain the world. And so basically what that means is that in that process of knowing self, letting go of that ego, which is actually very restrictive, that you lose self, you lose that identification, and you gain the world, meaning that you see yourself as getting rid of that illusion of the separate self, and you're part of this connected whole. Why don't we just end with a 30-second or like a few breath meditation. And once again, what we'll just do is this time just use the sound of the chime to enter into mindfulness, and then just listening to the sounds and the room, and then the chime to come out. Opening to whatever sounds you hear, bringing our attention to sounds in the room, out of the room, and then fully absorbing this, all the tones and the vibrations, the loudness, the softness of this chime.